Just a couple of minutes, maybe even seconds in one of our downtown areas gives you some idea of how tight the housing market is in our cities, because it's clear that there are people who spend a great deal of time on the streets with few other options for places to go. Communities here and around the country continue to struggle with answers for ways to get roofs over the heads of all the people. A discussion about this very topic visits two of our cities in the near future. AARP Oregon brings livability solutions forums to Springfield on April 12th and Medford on April 13th. We reached out to some of the guests and organizers from the Medford Forum for a bit of a preview. Connie Saldana is one of the organizers. She's a senior and disabled services planner with the Rogue Valley Council of Governments. RV COG will be the frequent reference you'll hear there. And she's been on the Rogue Valley Homeless Task Force for many years now. Connie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Guy Tower is back on the Jefferson Exchange, regional economist with the Oregon Employment Department. Guy, good to see you.
Nice to see you again, Jeff.
And we welcome Dan Parolek to the Jefferson Exchange, who's an architect and urbanist at Opticos Design in Berkeley. And he's come up with the concept of missing middle housing. Hi, Dan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
So, Connie, let's start with you, because you've worked on living wage and affordable housing campaigns for many years now. How would you assess the overall status of the Rogue Valley in addressing the problem of getting roofs over the heads of everybody who wants them?
Well, we live in a place that's very desirable, and housing is extremely tight. I work on the end of the scale of things where people have actually lost their housing for one reason or another, and trying to get them back into it is quite an amazing feat, because all of the subsidized housing has wait lists of at least a year or two, Section 8, 3 years, and so even if you have a voucher or if you have a small program like mine, which houses homeless people with disabilities, you can't find a place. On Craigslist, everybody who's listed there with a rental, I'm speaking rental housing now, of course, you know, they could have 40 people apply within a few hours, and it makes the people I serve very non-competitive.
So Section 8 is when you get a voucher for housing.
Yes.
Owned by somebody else. It's not
right.
Public housing. It's private.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can take it to any place in the valley. Now, actually, you can't. Realtors can't discriminate against. I shouldn't say realtors. Landlords can't discriminate against people with Section 8 voucher.
And the shortest wait list is a year. You're saying for either that or subsidized housing.
For the subsidized housing, Section 8 is more like 3 years.
Oh, is it 3 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's actually called housing voucher now, but it's hard to get.
Sure.
Get
a new terminology. So let's talk about some of the economic drivers here. Guy Tower, there was a recent statewide report on unemployment that looked like Oregon's unemployment was about as low as it's been since it's been recorded. How about Southern Oregon, though?
We're bouncing along the bottom as well. We're at historically low levels of unemployment. The February data just came out, and Jackson County's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate is 4%, Josephine County at 4.4%. So we have comparable data going back to 1990, and that's really a low point. So the labor markets are very tight. We've seen a pretty solid job growth over the past few years. We're really outpacing the state. It's taken longer for us to bounce back, but we're adding jobs at a pretty good clip in Southern Oregon.
Is it somewhat harder then for employers to fill jobs because that many people do have work already?
It is. We did a vacancy survey in 2016, and for various reasons, employers told us about 70% of the jobs they classified as difficult to fill, and statewide it's a little bit higher. Here in Southern Oregon, statewide, it's about 64% as difficult to fill. So it's a challenge for employers to find those people with the right skills to fill all the positions that are open right now.
So it's a kind of a buyer or seller's market for labor in that sense. But, I mean, what is this doing to incomes? Is it having much of an effect there?
Well, it certainly is helping with incomes. We've seen average wages in Jackson County, for example, rise about 16% from around 2011 through 2016. So we have seen wages come up a little bit in response to those tighter labor markets.
And then, so if income's not rising terribly quickly, what about the cost of housing?
That's where you run into the pinch, is the cost of housing has risen quite a bit. The average home price in Jackson County rose about 42% over those past 5 years. So while wages have gone up about 16%, the cost of the average home rising about 42% over those 5 years. So that's really where you're running into those affordability challenges in the Rogue Valley, is wages are just not keeping up with the pace of home price and rental price inflation.
Well, 42% over 5 years, that is a big number. So that brings us to the fact that we need more housing, which we've talked about a couple different times, more than a couple times on the Jefferson Exchange, and gives us a chance to bring in Dan Parolik now at OptiCoast Design in Berkeley. What does missing middle mean when you talk about missing middle housing?
Yeah, this is a concept that we came up with about 5 years ago in addressing sort of needs that different cities were approaching us about, and even builders and developers. But it's what it is house-scale buildings that happen to have multiple units in them. And these, it's like duplex, a fourplex, cottage courts. And these missing middle housing types exist in most neighborhoods built prior to the 1940s, and they provide a really diverse range of housing choices at different price points. And we call them missing because we've built very, very little of these over the course of the last 50 years. And part of this push is just to remove barriers, to enable builders to deliver more of these missing middle housing types to the market to address these address parts of these housing needs.
Why so little built over the last 50 years?
A lot of different barriers in place, and a lot of it sort of starts with zoning that makes it really hard to do sort of these multiple unit buildings in a lot of places in communities where they've zoned for single family. There's often very little land in communities zoned for multiple unit buildings. There's also just, you know, there's very few builders who are delivering, sort of building these housing types, and even gets much more complex to finance these projects. So there's a lot of different barriers, and we're working with a lot of different organizations to help remove these barriers.
We will learn more about missing middle housing from Dan Parolik at OptiCoast Design in Berkeley. We have Guy Tower, regional economist from the Oregon Employment Department, Connie Saldana from RVCOG, the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, talking about housing and homelessness. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. We'll come back with our guests and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about housing once again. We did have a chat yesterday with folks in Reading about the difficulty of trying to get new housing built that people can afford, which is an issue for a lot of communities, which is why AARP Oregon is holding a couple of livability solutions forums on the future of housing, one in Springfield on April 12th at the Sprout Market Hall, one in Medford at the Inn at the Commons the next day. And both 8:30 to noon. Connie Saldana, who works at works in the Senior and Disabled Services Division as a planner for the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, is one of the organizers for the Medford event. She's also been on the Rogue Valley Homeless Task Force for a long time. Guy Towers, a regional economist with the Oregon Employment Department. Dan Parolik is an architect and urbanist at OptiCoast Design in Berkeley, who has coined the term missing middle housing for units that are bigger than single family, but not quite into monstrous sort of housing complexes. And they'll be Guy and Dan in particular will be speaking at the Medford event on the 13th. You can join the conversation now, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dan Parolik, I want to continue exploring the concept of missing middle housing with you. I mean, was there a process of figuring out that it was missing and, oh, wow, that's what we don't have anymore kind of moment?
Well, the concept of this range of housing choices has been inherent in our architecture and urban design practice for over 20 years, and what it's done is it's proven to be a really great communication tool when we're working with communities and sort of doing visioning and long-term planning for a neighborhood or a downtown, and sort of getting away from very technical terms that planners and architects like to use, like density and multifamily, that tend to sort of get people up in arms. And the idea with missing middle is let's step away from that. Let's talk about housing choices by talking specifically about these range of housing types. You know, create a series of photo boards that show the range of these housing types and the choices that have existed in their community for a very long time, and talk about the appropriate scale and form and how they can provide a very livable context and also can be very compatible with the scale and character of what's currently in a neighborhood.
I see your point, though, that you're trying to be careful to not use terms like higher density, because those are the ones that do scare people a little bit. Missing middle sounds almost like a homecoming kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's part of the reason it's caught on all across the country. It's given communities a way to communicate about the need for housing choices at all sort of price points and affordability levels, without using those terms that are scary to a lot of people, and for very good reason.
How much more affordable, I mean, I don't know if you have any figures on percentages or that sort of thing, but how much more affordable missing middle housing is compared to trying to rent an entire house or trying to get an apartment in a big complex?
Well, it really varies based on sort of the unit size, the type it's in, and even just the, you know, what region in the country it's in. But as a starting point, the missing middle types can provide affordability by design, and that's usually kind of thinking about a term that we use a lot is average median income and targeting different levels of affordability. And that affordability by design can sort of target sort of 75% of average median income or above. And then we've been working with cities to put policies in place, whether it be density bonus programs or just, you know, tweaks to their zoning codes or impact fees to enable these types. And what's great about it is it's enabling a lot of housing choice without delivering housing in these really large apartment buildings that are popping up all over the place. And there's the right place for those. But, you know, part of this is, you know, there's a right place for those larger buildings, but we need to be thinking also about these house-scale buildings that just happen to have multiple units.
And that really is the point, I think, the house scale, is that they're not much bigger, and in some cases not at all bigger than just single-family homes. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, my neighborhood is a great example. I live in a small, 1,100-square-foot bungalow, but next to me is a duplex with two 1,100-square-foot units in it, and our friend lives in it with his wife and two children, and on the other side of the duplex, his parents live in. And I would say about 20% of the lots in our neighborhood have a duplex or a fourplex or a small, you know, 6 to 8 unit building on it, and it actually creates for a very diverse community provides a lot of those choices for people at different income levels, different points in their life where they want bigger units or smaller units, or more than anything in a neighborhood like mine, they want the walkability and access to transit.
We're talking about housing and particularly missing middle housing with Dan Parolek, who is the guy in charge of the term at the Opticos Design and Berkeley Architect and Urbanist, Guy Towers, Regional Economist with Oregon Employment, Connie Saldana with RV Cog, Rogue Valley Council of Governments. Connie, you've been a member of the Homeless Task Force in the Rogue Valley for 2 decades plus, is that right?
Mm-hmm, yes, since 1990.
And are we making progress, or are we losing ground?
Well, in terms of people who can't remain in housing because of affordability, I think we're currently, in the last few years at least, losing ground. We may have made progress for a while, but definitely our numbers of homeless people are increasing.
And some of the, when we get into numbers, I know that Dan was talking more about where people's income is relative to the average, but there's also the major issue that we keep running into of how much of income people are paying for housing. And when you are dealing with people at RV Cog who have just kind of fallen out of housing, what had they been paying as a percentage of income often?
Oh, well, I think 50% is very common, but a person on a fixed income, if their landlord, if they've been paying $600 a rent and their landlord raises their rent to $1,100, as we've seen happen.
From how much?
Yeah, $650 or $675 to $1,100 in the course of 2 years. And that person just can't live there when their income, for that particular woman I'm thinking of, her income was $1,250. So the market is not incentivizing people to keep their rents low. Let's just put it that way.
And so, Guy Tower, as the economist here, what leads to that? I mean, I've seen statements from landlords, fortunately not to me over the years, but to you know, nieces and nephews and things like that. This is what the market will bear, is what the letter will say. I mean, but this doesn't really reflect what the costs of the owner are, but just what they can get for the rental. Is there a lot of that in the Rogue Valley that you see?
Well, certainly we've seen continued population growth. For example, in Jackson County, just over the past 5 years, our population is up by about 7,700 people just in 5 years. Josephine County added about 1,000 new residents. At the same time, the rate of building activity is still at a very subdued level. So, for example, from 1988 through about 2007, we had over 1,000 residential building permits issued in Jackson County, and that really spiked in 2003 through 2005 when we were over 2,000 residential permits a year. And that number really fell when the Great Recession hit. The number of permits hit a bottom in Jackson County, for example, of about 320 permits, so just at one-seventh the level that we saw just a few years earlier by 2009. And since then, building permit activity and building activity has risen slightly, but in 2016, there were only about 700 residential permits issued for new building in Jackson County. About 550 of those were single-family units. About 145 were units five or greater, so apartments and other multiple unit buildings. So we've just seen it's just that basic supply and demand is what's causing that upward pressure on rental prices. And we've really seen that in some of the indexes. Zillow has just a wealth of data on housing costs and affordability, prices, both the rental side, price per square foot. So there's a lot of data that really shows that spike in rental costs really just in the past couple of years. So, for example, during the period going back from 1980 through 2006, say through mid-2006, looking at rental costs compared to income in Jackson County, the ratio stayed pretty constant. It was about 26% was the average rent compared to people's income. Through early 2014, that ratio jumped to 0.3, and it really spiked in the last couple of years up to 0.38. So we're really far above that historical norm in terms of the cost of rental versus average income in Jackson County.
You know, I know you're a specialist in Southern Oregon, but I've had people in Portland tell me that it actually costs them less per month to buy a house than to rent. Have you heard anything like that there or here?
The cost of rentals is rapidly approaching what monthly homeowner costs are. But here, homeowner costs or home prices have spiked as well. So it's a challenge both on the rental side and the home ownership side.
And those prices came back pretty fast after the recession, didn't they? It didn't seem like Rogue Valley's gutter was a very deep one.
Well, we did lose quite a bit. So looking at like the price per square foot, I like to look at that because it kind of takes away, you look at some of the realtor data, and that depends on the mix of homes that happen to have been sold 1 month to the next. But looking at the price per square foot, it peaked in Jackson County at about $180 a square foot for housing to purchase a home in about 2000, late 2005, 2006. So we peaked at about $180 per square foot, hit a bottom in 2012 when prices did drop in the market in Jackson County down to about $100 a square foot. And now we're back up to about $160 a square foot as of the end of 2016. So our prices aren't quite back to that pre-recession peak during the housing bubble of the mid-2000s, but we're rapidly approaching that level recently.
Definitely getting close. Guy Towers, an economist with the Oregon Employment Department, serving. He's a Southern Oregon regional economist. Connie Saldana is a senior disabled services planner at RVCOG, the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, and a longtime member of the Rogue Valley Homeless Task Force. Dan Perolek is an architect and urbanist at Opticos Design in Berkeley. He's come up with the concept of missing middle housing, putting housing that is larger than single family but smaller than large complex type units. You can join the conversation about housing and how to get people into it in our cities. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Connie?
Well, I'd just like to tie a little bit of our conversation about the shortage of housing with Dan's visit to the Rogue Valley. I'm really excited about any creative solutions to create more housing in our area, because at whatever level, except maybe the huge single-family homes, any housing we create is going to make housing available at the lower end of the scale for the people I'm talking about. there's going to be more of it. And I love the creativity of Dan's project, and I can't wait to hear him talk to us. And I know he's also going to be meeting with builders and our local jurisdictional planners while he's here.
And so, Dan, what are some of the features of missing middle housing? It seems to be it's a bit more urban than suburban.
Yeah, and I think they do function best in what we call a walkable community, because what we find is that the units tend to be a little bit smaller, and people are willing to trade a slightly smaller unit for the ability to walk down the street to a coffee shop or to a restaurant or to a movie theater, like exists in the small towns that are sprinkled throughout Northern California and Southern Oregon. And I think that's a part of the reason sort of housing is in costs are rising, because there's a growing demand for that walkability. But so smaller units, sometimes the missing middle housing types, they live like a single family house. You're not living in a big condo or apartment building where you're having to walk upstairs and go down a long dark corridor to get into your unit. You usually can enter the unit sort of directly off of the sidewalk or a shared courtyard space. They also tend to provide a really strong sense of community. Linda Pruitt, who's a developer up in the Seattle area who owns the Cottage Company, talks about how she builds great little cottage courts, little 600 square foot cottages around a shared green space, and says that her number one buyers are single women, and what it looks like is that type portion of the market is really looking for the sense of community that's created by that type of housing in particular. So, and even just the neighborhoods that are composed of these mix of types tend to have a really diverse sort of engaging community as part of them. People are really longing for that.
That actually is part of the attraction. It's a visual sort of thing, isn't it? Some of the missing middle appeal, because you're not dealing with gigantic buildings or large complexes, but just sort of a two-story here, a three-story there, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. The ones we've documented and designed, they don't get bigger than typically two stories, sometimes two and a half based on the context. So, right, that's back to that house scale. It's about the height of it. It's about, it behaves like a house, even though you might drive or ride your bike by one of these missing middle triplexes or fourplexes every day and not even notice that there's multiple units in it, because it looks like a house. It just happens to have the several units integrated into the building.
So by necessity, does missing middle construction new need to be either close enough to walk or along transit routes or both?
Well, it doesn't need to be, but ideally it definitely is. So obviously that's a lot easier in an infill condition where you're looking to fill some gaps in an existing neighborhood that's close to a downtown or maybe has a little neighborhood main street area with a bagel shop or some other small services that are provided. But we are working with developers or builders right now to actually create new walkable neighborhoods that are composed, that have a really great mix of missing middle housing within them. Currently actually working with a developer in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. If this is happening in Nebraska, it's like people are looking at it all over. But to create a new 60-acre walkable neighborhood that has eight different missing middle housing types in it and sort of a new neighborhood main street to provide that walkability.
Let us take a call. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about housing with Dan Parolek, Connie Saldana, and Guy Tower.
Well, it's always nice to talk to another Connie. How do you do? I had just a couple of comments. The program yesterday, I believe, was with a gentleman from Reading.
David Rutledge, yeah.
And one of the things he talked about that actually quite upset me was that he was talking about building these four-bedroom units, and at the same time, he was discussing the fact that, he had just all these people that could not get into the previous units that he'd had, tremendous backlog.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, all of us, I'm 65, many of us grew up in a two-bedroom house with a family. And all over the world, people have one- and two-bedroom houses and apartments, and that's considered very, quote, middle class, sort of leave it to Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, I think we have somehow incorporated this McMansion idea that, we all have to have all this room for ourselves within our housing, as opposed to other ways of designing things to have more room. And I just hope that, as you say, there's this dearth of housing for studios and one and two bedrooms that would house so many more people. And obviously, we were not harmed by, you know, sleeping two to a room or in bunk beds and et cetera. So I just am very concerned that people are looking at having larger units rather than trying to house more people. And the other side to this, which I've seen here, and I assume your people from different areas have seen, is the conversion of rental housing in the Airbnb. And I have seen in my area here a tremendous number of units being converted over to a B&B situation, which would be housing families or single persons or whatever.
Okay, good points to bring up, Connie. We'll have to take a break, and then I want to come back and give it to the other Connie for we can get some illumination on what's going on in the Rogue Valley here. Connie Saldana is with RV Cog, Guy Towers with the Oregon Employment Department, Dan Perolik is with Opticos Design in Berkeley, the expert in missing middle housing. We'll come back and resume the conversation about creating more housing for the many people who need it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking once again about the very, very tight housing markets in cities in our region and what some of the solutions might be to get homes built for all the people who want them at reasonable prices. AARP Oregon is hosting Livability Solutions Forums on the future of housing in both Springfield and Medford. It'll be in Springfield at the Sprout Market Hall April 12th from 8:30 to noon, in at the Commons in Medford April 13th from 8:30 to noon. Connie Saldana is one of the organizers for the Medford event. She is a senior and disabled services planner with RV Cog and a longtime member of the Rogue Valley Homeless Task Force. Guy Towers is the regional economist for the Oregon Employment Department based in Medford. Dan Perolik, architect and urbanist at Opticos Design in Berkeley, the expert on missing middle housing, the stuff that's bigger than single family but not as big as giganto complex. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Ideas for how to approach the issue with unaffordable housing in our regions. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So Connie and Eugene got a chance to lay her questions on us before the break, but one of the questions she had was about multiple families or multiple people living in homes and multiple people in bedrooms. I mean, do we have a mindset, Connie Saldana, about the kinds of housing we expect now, that it is just one person per bedroom?
Well, I'm not a developer, but I imagine if I were, I'd be thinking you could make more money off of more bedrooms. But when we see on the end of scale that I'm working with families doubling up, and actually in motel rooms, mm-hmm. because two families have lost their housing, I think we could easily go a couple kids or four kids in a bedroom and in a two-bedroom home.
Dan Perolik, what's the general rule of thumb when you're building missing middle housing and designing it? What kinds of things do you think about in terms of density within the house?
Yeah, it's interesting that even just the shift that's been happening over the course of the last 10 to 15 years in household demographics is really sending a strong message that we need to be building smaller housing types. 30% of all households currently are single-person households. There's one person living in a house, so you can imagine 30%. One-third of the market is how the households are one person. And the U.S. Census has shown that by 2025, 75 to 85% of all households will not have children. So we definitely need to be having this discussion, and it's part of the discussion we always have with the missing middle, is the need for the smaller units. And when we mean small, like when I was at a professional builder housing conference last week, they were talking about small in terms of 2,600 square foot. I said, no, we need to redefine small. Small is sub-1,000 square feet, and that's great for baby boomers, sort of downsizing, sort of looking to move to a more walkable location a lot of times, sort of young couples, millennials getting started. Obviously, those smaller units don't specifically address the needs of the the larger households. But I think what Connie mentioned earlier is really important, that by providing these smaller units that the market is really looking for, you can kind of relieve the pressure on some of those larger units, because we're finding people are just staying in those larger units longer or permanently because they're not being provided other choices.
The other part of Connie from Eugene's question, though, was about Airbnb and the dent that she perceived it making in the rental market. And either Connie or Guy, I wonder if you have any facts and figures about the less rental housing available for long-term rentals because people do want to rent their homes to vacationers.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's a huge issue here in Southern Oregon. I haven't it hasn't something that's really been across my radar screen. But certainly, I think what we really saw during the Great Recession is when so many people did lose their homes, that those homes that might have been in owned by a family, I think were a lot of those were bought up by investors who saw that when the market really did fall out of the bottom, those folks that were cash rich were able to buy those homes at fire sale prices. I know in one situation, there was a person that just stayed in their home for about 3 years without making a payment to the bank. And then finally, when prices did start to rise, the bank did proceed with foreclosures. And so basically, they kept the tenant in there, basically keeping the lights on and the place watered and the grass alive until prices came back up. And then they did proceed finally to foreclose on them. But then I think what you saw is investors going into the market and buying up some of that property and kept those for income properties versus letting those houses stay in the owner-occupied market. And so I think a lot of those starter and smaller and lower cost homes were that where people did lose their homes during that Great Recession and the bust in housing were bought up by investors and just kept the supply available in the market. So if we look at the number of homes currently available in Jackson County, for example, back in the spring of 2011, there were about 1,800 homes available for purchase in Jackson County. By the fall of 2015, that number had slipped to about 1,000. By the fall of 16, we were down to about 750. And most currently, according to data from Zillow, about 520 homes available. So we've really seen that squeeze in the available of inventory, and that's been another contributing factor in the rise in prices we've seen.
Okay, so yeah, about a third of what was available then 6 years ago, based on this Zillow data. We have an email here from Mike, no location. He says, it's baffling that the Rogue Valley continues to build sprawling single-family homes. It's almost as if local planners have no concept of building up. Downtown Medford is a continual failure because there's no housing above the retail stores. Medford police push the homeless to Bear Creek. Our local politicians seem to lack the knowledge to solve these problems. Connie Saldana, you've been working at this most directly for 25 years or so now in the Rogue Valley with the homeless task force. What are some of the obstacles that prevent solutions? And again, you mentioned that there do seem to be more homeless now.
Well, I think just... Well, for one thing, HUD, which is the original source of funding for very low-income housing, has reduced the number of units it makes available hugely in the last 20 years or
because
something.
Because of budget cuts? Or
yeah, just it's not a priority for Congress, who sets the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what's going to happen with HUD and the current administration? Things are kind of in turmoil. So that means if subsidized housing isn't being provided, it has to be the market that provides it. One of the other areas I work in my work is with accessible housing. And I know that builders are not interested in building homes that are accessible for people to live in for the rest of their lives, because they've told me, I can sell everything I build with the same plans I've been using for the last 30 years, so why should I change? And it might also apply to affordability. If builders can sell everything that they build because there's such a low supply, then why should they build housing that's less profitable?
Oh, these are some excellent questions. So let me bring this back to Dan Parolek. In the missing middle housing setups that you've worked with, was there some public money in there, or was it generally a private project?
Well, no, we're really excited. We're actually starting to do some work with some affordable housing developers to build some subsidized missing middle scale housing, and we're really excited because it's just not that common. But especially here in the Bay Area, where the affordable housing developers are just kind of running out of the lowest hanging fruit and sort of looking for more creative ways to deliver affordability, that missing middle in a more sort of strategic and tactical application can be part of their sort of their toolbox of affordable housing. And so I think we'll start to see more and more of that all across the country in cities of all different sizes.
That last email struck a chord because it was he talked about something that you specifically talk about, the live-work buildings where there are, in fact, houses above retail.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what that brought up in my mind is just the whole, not just the notion of trying to occupy the housing above the ground floor commercial spaces, but also just figuring out ways at the edges of that downtown or those neighborhoods that surround those downtowns to enable these missing middle housing types, because there's probably a good mix of them already. But the market's looking for this. So in places, and especially the smaller communities, the builders have been really slow to respond. But all across the country in cities of various sizes, we're getting calls from builders saying we realize the market's really shifting. We've historically built single-family homes, but we want to figure out how we can integrate missing middle into our housing type portfolio so that we can sort of hit this shift in the market right now. 60% of millennials and almost 30% of baby boomers, and that's a big percentage of the population, have a preference for missing middle housing. So if builders aren't currently responding to it, they're going to need to very soon.
When did the missing middle concept really take shape and the name get applied? I'm just curious to know where it fell in time in relation to the McMansion boom of the mid-aughts.
Yeah, well, like I said, the concept has been inherent in our practice for a long time, but it was about 2011 over the course of, through the projects we were working on and just speaking at several conferences, it made me realize that we need to give this range of housing types the name that is approachable, removes that stigma that is inherent in a lot of communities about talking about non-single-family housing choices. And get away from those, like I said earlier, get away from talking about increases in density, because which neighborhood's going to say, yeah, we want to approve an increase in density in our neighborhood, because that can mean a lot of different things, and it's usually not, the neighbors usually aren't envisioning good things when they're thinking about that. So let's educate them, let's show examples of what these missing middle housing types are and talk about which ones would be appropriate in different parts of neighborhoods. They're not appropriate wholesale everywhere, but there's a lot of opportunities in towns, small towns and bigger cities to do these types.
We have an email from Bill, no town given. He writes that land availability is a significant cost in housing. What about cities becoming more proactive in condemned properties and land the city owns to help the good people in need? Now, I know the city has devoted some land up by its service center, the city of Medford on Columbus Avenue, to a tiny house village for homeless people. But when I expand this into some thoughts, too, about like downtown Medford, for example, Dan, has all these acres of car lots that have moved out to the outskirts of town. I mean, would you advocate turning commercial land into residential in some cases?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those corridors are prime opportunities for infill housing and at various scales. And you just have to be really careful. At some point, if a street gets above a certain level of traffic count, it's not a great location for housing, or you just need to design it in a way so that it's mitigating the impacts of that traffic. But a lot of those, especially the secondary corridors that were zoned for commercial and have seen they're not performing financially, or maybe even be vacant, have vacant buildings or vacant land, are actually really great opportunities for missing middle housing.
Guy Tower, was rental growth in the Southern Oregon market already somewhat behind the population growth even before the recession?
Well, in Jackson County, about a third of the homes are rental occupied, about two thirds are owner occupied, and that's been fairly consistent over time.
Mm-hmm. And how does that compare with other markets around the country?
Quite similar. Our mix is about the same, but I think the demand is what's really pushing prices up. As some people lost their homes during that downturn. And they didn't have the financing, maybe didn't have the income or employment that they had maybe before the recession. And so those former homeowners may be in the rental market now. And we just haven't seen the increase in supply related to the population growth and maybe the number of people looking for rental homes. The millennials, we have the highest percent of people age 35 and under still living with parents. So we just have the really pretty low rate of new household formation, related to, debt with student loans and just the inability to come up with a down payment and just to be able to move into the
start homes. So there's some pent-up demand as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wonder, Connie, I know since you live down the hall from some, work down the hall from some planners, I mean, there is some regional planning efforts to open up land faster for the building of homes, isn't there?
Well, definitely they've done the regional solutions.
Mm-hmm. Regional problem solving.
Thank you. Embarrassed that that's from my own organization. I don't know the name. Anyway, definitely thinking about it. And I think what I heard is that every city except Ashland in our area has decided to expand its urban growth boundary. We're hoping that means more multiple family dwellings, mm-hmm. right? But I don't see that there's any restriction on that. I don't know what's planning to come. And I hope that this forum that we're going to have will influence more of the multiple family.
Great
homes.
Segue and lead out. It is the Livability Solutions Forum, the Future of Housing, in Springfield on April 12th at the Sprout Market Hall, 8:30 to noon. Medford Inn at the Commons the next day, April 13th, also 8:30 to noon. Dan Parolik will be there talking about missing middle housing. He's an architect and urbanist at Opticos Design in Berkeley. Guy Tower at the Medford session. He's a regional economist for the Oregon Employment Department. And Connie Saldana is organizing or helping organize the Medford event. She's a senior disabled services planner at RVCOG and a member of the Rogue Valley Homeless Task Force. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.